94.5 WELY, it is time for our weekly wilderness update, brought to you by the BWCAW Coalition, funded by Lake County and St. Louis County. I'm Brett Ross, and joining me this week to talk about loons is Sherry Apps. Thanks for joining us, Sherry.
Thanks for this opportunity.
So I have been told, and I've read over the years in the local newspapers, that you have a real fascination for loons. Tell me how this came to be.
Oh, well, back in 1993, I spent part of a summer at Seney Wildlife Refuge in Michigan, mm-hmm. and I got to meet and work with Dr. David Evers and Dr. James Peruk, and they just happened to be two of the top researchers in the country. Of course, they were only young men in their 20s, you know, getting their master's and their PhD, but it was the beginning of the mushroom of data collection based on capturing loons at night and putting leg bands on them so that they actually knew who was who and where they were going and, you know, if they came back to the same place. A lot of questions were answered. So that's my background started in 93 at Seney Wildlife Refuge in Michigan, Upper Michigan, and then I also did, or am still doing, about 10 years in Wisconsin for the Loon Watch program out of Northland College. In Minnesota, I've been there 11 years and heading up about 40 lakes that people report to me, and then I do some myself, and that's for the Minnesota DNR Loon Watcher program. We really have two different programs in Minnesota. And then just the past four winters, I've been working with Dr. Jay Mager in South Carolina, and we're doing wintering loons, okay. What's going on with them in the winter. So that's kind of a background. I just happen to get some of the best folks in the whole country.
Well, that's incredibly fortunate, you know, to start out with an interest like that, but then be able to learn from some of the top researchers in the country. That's really fascinating. So talk a little bit about what the loons are up to right now here in, at the end of September.
Yeah. The loons right now are, it depends on which loon you're talking about, age and whether they had chicks or not. The adult loons without chicks have already left by like end of August.
Oh, really?
For sure, the beginning. Yeah. If they had, we had a lot of eggs fail and predators taking eggs, a lot of nesting that ended up to be in water was way too low, and so that upset a lot of nesting. So there was a lot of nesting failures. So any adults that did not have a successful nest or had chicks taken by eagles or snapping turtles or some other predator, then if they did not have any chicks by the end of August, then they start to raft up with their social groups, lots of social groups going on, and then they are gone already. I've gone back to their natal, to their lakes where they've been having a territory, and they're gone. The adults that do have chicks, most of those chicks are at least 9 weeks, 10 weeks, 11 weeks old, some of them even a little bit older. Those adults will hang around. Actually, a lot of the males have left already, and so it's the females that are left. And, of course, you know, in nature, that can always change. So we think most of the males leave first, and there's always exceptions. And then there'll be one adult left with the chicks, and the chicks are actually called juveniles now. Once they have that all gray and they're over 8 weeks old, they have a better chance of making it on their own. They still beg from the parents, so you'll see them doing a lot of begging, you know, touching the bill of the parent, trying to beg. But they also are able to forage some by themselves.
Okay.
So, and then some of the lakes that have had chicks, both adults are gone. So there's a couple of lakes I do near Virginia, and all the chicks and all the adults are gone already. So where did they go? They are usually checking out lakes in the neighboring areas, okay, and they're just eating a lot, so they're underwater a lot, and they're deciding who they're going to go migrate with. The males and females do not migrate together.
Really?
So they don't go as a pair like geese and swans. that they go in different groups. We don't know everybody who's in their small little groups, but they are hanging out and doing a lot of social stuff. And then juveniles are kind of left on their hatch lake by themselves, perhaps even for a month or two. So you might still see juveniles there practicing flying, and then they will start checking out neighboring lakes and maybe meet some other juveniles or go by themselves. So it's always interesting. We don't know how they can figure out how to migrate for the first time in their lives all the way down to the south, the southern areas, but they do. So that's kind of what's happening for what's going on with our chicks. And how late will they stay in Minnesota? They will stay for another couple of weeks or so. It's possible. A lot of the migration that's going on, they go to the northern part of Lake Michigan, and they hang out there for like a week or so. They eat as much fish as they can, lots of resting, preening, and eating. And then they go maybe to the southern end of Michigan. And we've got that data from Kevin Kinu of USGS. I got to go on a couple of night captures with him in 2014. Anyway, so it's based on his data and his research, and he covers the whole Midwest, that we were able to see that, oh, yeah, they hang out in the northern part of Michigan, and then they hang out in the southern part of Lake Michigan, and then they will go the rest of the way.
So there's some really fascinating things in there. One is sort of the social groups where you'll have the sort of couples group that don't have any children. Those couples kind of hang out together. And then the ones that do have young, it's sort of the males connecting with the males, the females connecting with the females. Is that typically how that works?
Usually in the beginning of the summer, the males fight the males for the territory. So back in 93, the researchers were able to prove that they don't marry each other. They marry a lake. They're much more married to lake areas.
Got it.
You know, within 10 miles or so of their natal lake. Females disperse a little bit further, but males fight males, females fight females. So in the beginning of the year, when people in Ely saw them fighting, there usually was one just like hanging out. So that was the gender that was not fighting.
Got it.
So but yeah, and as far as who they migrate with, we're still barely scratched the surface with who they're migrating with. Are they migrating with older and younger ones, you know, ones that are over 3 years old? Because the juveniles don't come back for 3 years. They don't even come back to the Midwest for 3 years. Yeah.
And so they stay in their sort of wintering area for that whole time.
They actually, and because of Kevin Kinu and his research on migration with USGS, they actually do move around, but they don't come back to their natal lake. So we've had, he has documented that some of our loons from Minnesota near the Virginia area, Arrowhead Lake, north of Virginia, as well as Shagawa Lake, we captured a couple there, those juveniles, and some of them, and other ones in Michigan and Minnesota, and they actually went up the East Coast for their first summer and hung out along there, but one of them went all the way to Saskatchewan.
Oh, wow, no kidding.
And another one went to Nova Scotia.
Really?
Yeah, so we're just like, we just don't have enough data to say, you know, where do most of them go? We're seeing a scattering, and those were the juveniles. So they go up and down that coast and some other places, up down the north and south on the Atlantic coast for those first 2.5 years or so. Then when they're 3 years old, most of them come back, and then that's when they're going to hang out, learn the best they can about lakes. And they usually don't nest until they're 6 years old.
Wow, 6 years.
Yeah.
And so then at that point, they sort of choose the lake that they feel is right to begin to breed, and then they stick with that lake?
Yes, year after year, they'll try to stick with that lake. But again, you know, some of them are injured, some of them are not very experienced, they'll get kicked off their lake. In Wisconsin, they have documentation of a son, a male, coming back after 3 years, and by the time it was six, it kicked its father off the lake.
Oh, wow.
So
time to move on, old man.
Yeah, right. And then the males and, I mean, the females fight each other for that lake, too. So what they do is they try to get a good lake with a lot of good habitat.
Mm-hmm.
And then they try to stick to that. But there's always fights about it. And it's going to be the ones that are more experienced, a little older or tougher or in better physical shape. Those are the ones that are going to hang out. So, you know, whoever wins the fight, then they just get whatever the partner is.
Wow.
So sometimes they do come back time after time. And I think the most that's been documented is about 7 years on the average. They might stay together about 7 years, but they don't migrate together.
Okay.
Males migrate without the females, and females migrate without the males, and they just meet each other on the lake again. And so about 7 years was about the average from the documentation that they have, but there are always exceptions. It's Simi Wildlife Center, which is one of the longest studies. They have a male that's 34 years old, and a female that's like 33 years old, something like that. And they have had chicks together in one of the same areas at Simi Wildlife.
That's amazing.
But that's unusual. That's very unusual.
So it's always been really fascinating to me when it comes to migratory birds that it seems they have their own built-in GPS system.
Yeah.
Absolutely incredible to me that they will migrate to the same area, they'll return to the same area. Can you talk about the process of migration, where they end up going to, some of the the hazards that they face along the way, and in that in that wintering area as well?
Yes. And again, migration is still something that's only been studied for about 10 years instead of 40 years.
Mm-hmm.
So we're still just kind of tipping, just the top of the iceberg on that. But most of them will migrate on an empty stomach.
Hmm.
That was really interesting to me because they're a heavy bird. The males in the Midwest, and depending on where you are, if you're in the middle of Canada, you don't weigh as much and you have a really long migration.
Hmm.
Okay, Midwestern loons are males. Should weigh about 10 pounds, our females about 8.5 to 9 pounds. And you really can't tell them apart. So the researchers say if you see her laying the egg, that's the female.
Mm-hmm.
And if you see him do the yodel call, that's the male. And then once they both go under the water, you can't tell anymore.
That's great.
But yes, the migration in the spring is very, very fast. They're coming, fastest ever recorded was 8 hours straight, constant flying. They can't do any soaring at all. Maybe when they're coming down to the water, like if they're going to land, then they kind of slow up. But basically 8 hours straight, constant flapping. It's 3 flaps per second or something like that. Really amazing. And they clocked it at 650 miles at 73 miles per hour with a tailwind.
That is incredible.
That's
like the Iron Man of birds.
Yes, exactly. And that is to get up here. And why would they want to come that fast? That's because they need to get to their favorite lake, the one they like the best or the one that they want to fight and take it over.
So when that that changing of season starts, it's basically a race to get to the lake that they want to get to. What are the sort of determining factors? You know, this week we've got some exceptionally warm weather for late September. Is it a is it a weather factor, temperatures? Is it more about the positioning of the sun?
Yeah, two different things you're hitting upon, and both of them have some validity. If they are coming and wanting to go really fast, they will not fly in bad weather, okay? They will not fly if there's a overcast, We think perhaps they can tell the barometric pressure.
Okay.
So they have to pick a good day. It's best if the wind is going the direction they're going.
Sure.
You know? So they will go into the wind always on a takeoff because they're a very heavy bird. But then they're hoping for a tailwind when they're going, you know, south. And then when they're going north, you know, a tailwind going north so that they can, you know, get the most mileage for their heavy bodies.
Yeah.
And then on the way, like now in the fall, it's not a race. Mm-hmm. So if they're lollygagging, Kevin Kinu has documented because of the transmitters that he put on and the geolocators that he put on these birds that they hang out in the top of the northern part of Lake Michigan, and they just eat, raft up, you know, rest, preen, and eat some more. And they could do that for a week or two. And then the same thing in the southern part of Lake Michigan. Before they finally go down to Indiana, Ohio, Kentucky, Illinois, those places will see migrating birds coming through already. You know, some of those ones that did not have chicks would be coming through there. And then we've seen more and more, according to eBird on the Cornell websites, that there's more and more migrating birds that are staying in clean water, clear water, in reservoirs in Kentucky, Virginia, Tennessee, North Carolina, South Carolina, Northern Georgia, places like that. And so we are starting to just begin some wintering research in some of those areas where loons are. Now, most of them are not doing that. Most of them, like 90% of them, go to the Gulf of Mexico or to the Atlantic coast. All along that Atlantic coast, Florida, Georgia, South Carolina, North Carolina has a big intercoastal waterway kinds of things that they can get out of some of the storms of the ocean. And you were talking about, yes, there's lots of things that happen. There are bigger boats out there. There's fast boats when they're in the ocean. There's more waves. There's more turbidity in the water. They're digging around for, you know, crabs and stuff that doesn't have as much nutrients as the big healthy fish in the northern lakes. They hunt by sight. So, you know, the stirring up of the ocean and all the hurricanes and stuff, that's all dangerous for them. Nets that have been cut and are just floating, they get caught in. Oil spills, boat hits, you know, there's a lot of stuff going on in the winter. And the other thing that happens, even though they won't take off, I mean, they take off for a migration early in the morning if they can, like right at sunrise. And most of their migration coming up or going back down to the south, most of it is run by the photoperiod, the sunlight, mm-hmm. not really the weather. So it can be colder or warmer or whatever, but it's really the photoperiod that makes them go migrate one direction or the other direction, depending on the season. But, they will not do it if there's a storm or a storm that's coming. Then they'll just hunker down for a while. But what does happen, and this happened in April on the way up in the spring, the loon watching folks, they're called loon rangers. Actually, it's not a made up name. I actually have a certificate for it. But the loon rangers in Wisconsin actually documented there might have been more than 100 that just, it's called an ice event and loon fallout. And they literally dropped from the skies.
Wow.
And it was because by the time they got to Wisconsin and they're looking for lakes, there was a freak ice storm mm-hmm. that came through. And they were like a plane up in the sky. They were totally encased. When they were found on the ground, they were totally encased. Their eyes, their beak, their head, their wings, everything was totally encased. Now, the loon rangers, there's about 450 loon rangers in Wisconsin. They were out there finding as many bodies as they could, and they were able to save about 15, I think. And Marge Gibson is a vet in Antigo, Wisconsin, so they were trying to rehab as many as they could. But a lot of them, you know, they just fell in fields, and they cannot walk on land.
Right.
So, not at all. So that they can end up in bad weather, but that's usually not what they plan for because it's a death, you know. So.
Wow, some really fascinating thing. What an amazing bird. You know, I you know, having grown up, spending a lot of time in the summer in northern Minnesota and being on lakes and just listening to the loon behavior, watching loon behavior, it's just such a fascinating bird. Could you touch on just one final thing? You know, when you were talking about the sort of territorial issues, I was lucky enough to witness that. I have been a few times over the years, but this past spring to witness two males sort of battling for their territory, and it's just a fascinating display to see. I'm curious, though, specifically the sounds that they make, because I know there's the sort of tremolo call, the yodel call. There's that sort of low, sort of mournful call. Can you talk about what those different sounds mean?
Yeah, sure. And Dr. Jay Mager, who I work with in the winter, he also is an expert on loon behavior and loon calls. So I learned a lot from him. There's like a whole talk just on the yodel. So the yodel is, it sounds like somebody's possessed. You know, by crazy, you know, it sounds like a Halloween thing or something. It's really wild. It's only done by the males. But that yodel tells three things about a male. One, this is my individual voice print. So, like, Brett has a special voice print. We know his voice print compared to some other guy. So that's it, you know. So they have a voice print. That's the first part of the sonogram on the yodel. And then the next thing has two bits of information. One, it's, you do not want to mess with me because I am really, really tough. I have so much muscle mass that you don't even want to try to take over my lake. So, and that would be a really, really low frequency. Mm-hmm. And so they know that from each other. And so then a younger one may back off and try again next year or something. So how tough they are and how much muscle mass. And then the other thing is, will I take it to the max? So the repeat phrases after the initial part of the yodel, there's repeat phrases. And everyone who really listens to the yodel, you can tell, you could count those repeat phrases. If it's only repeated like three times, four times, five times, that means this is my lake and I will defend it. This is my territory. And if it's 15 times, 16 times, or more, it means I'm going to fight to the death.
Wow.
So, the male yodel is very interesting. The other one, the tremolo is that up and down, melodical, up and down, up and down. And that is, the yodel, of course, is a danger call. They will do that with eagles or another predator of any kind or another loon. And then the tremolo call, both the male and female do. And again, a boat is too close, or there's somebody too close to their nest, or there's an eagle above. So tremolo, lots of tremolo. And that lets the chicks know to hide or to dive or to something like that.
Okay.
And then the other one is the whale, which people who don't know northern Minnesota much, they think it's a wolf howling.
Right.
It's just, you know, one note, two notes, or sometimes three notes, but that very mournful call. Some of the juveniles are doing that now because they're calling to a parent, but the parents are gone. So, that's the whale call. And then there's the very, very soft hoot call, which is just kind of a contact, you know, how are you, I'm okay, you know, that kind of a thing. The whale call is also a contact, but it can be used for warning them about an eagle or something like that. There's a couple other very soft calls that a maw or a mew or a cluck, and those are used only with the parents or the chicks really close and something's going on. Sometimes it's when they're injured, you know, or they're looking for each other. Does that help?
Oh, it certainly does. It's really incredible to know that. And I was thinking specifically as I was getting ready for this conversation about something that happened a while back. I was kayaking on a lake in the area and had come around an island to about 10 loons that had all rafted together. This was late in the summer. And a friend who was behind me, as I found myself very close to these loons, and they were pretty quiet until one of them made that little tremolo call, and my friend who was behind me made that call back, and all of these loons went absolutely berserk. They started dancing around on the water and just making calls like crazy. And I thought, what did we just start? And they and they made a real strong effort to get away as fast as they could. And then they all took off and took flight.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. The tremolo call would be one that is danger. So they were, and when your friend answered, that just meant, oh no, there's something. This is worse than we thought.
Right, like danger
and
close.
So, yeah, danger way too close. If you had, other people have had a loon pop up like that close to them, and if you stay really quiet and say nothing or give a little hoot, sometimes they will give a hoot back.
Yep.
And again, some of them are very habituated to people that are respectful, and let them approach you. Don't you approach them.
Yep.
And, of course, you did that by accident. But that was probably a raft of, it could have been, here again, we don't know everybody who's in the raft. They could be older ones and younger ones, older ones that have been kicked off their territory, younger ones that don't have a territory yet, or late in the summer, somebody who's socializing that doesn't need to take care of a chick anymore and had the summer off. So, and we don't know, males or females or mixed.
Right.
We're not sure about all those rafts, but there definitely are rafts.
And I've had both experiences as well, where I've been solo in a canoe and had a loon come up right beside me and just very calmly just kind of drifted along with it. I've been on an inner tube. When I was a kid, I was on an inner tube and just staring down into the water, and a loon swam right underneath me and popped up next to me. And if you stay calm, then they just they have no reason to really be afraid of you, and they'll kind of hang around, and it's really fun thing to experience because they're such an incredible bird.
Yeah, they really are. And they do need our help because, like, the 7 mortality factors that they have, all of those are pretty much due to us.
Mm-hmm.
most of the stuff that we can't control, like the eagles or the snapping turtles, we can't do anything about. But the other things we can, and getting them all stirred up, obviously, we're on vacation. Here's the thing that I tell all my loon watcher folks that are helping me with these DNR surveys is we're on vacation, but they're trying to survive.
Yeah,
so
that's life and death every day for them.
Yeah, right. For every day, they need to find enough time to rest and eat and preen, feed a family, and things like that.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, Sherry, thank you so much for sharing all this information. It's so incredible to hear this, and I really appreciate you taking the time to share this wealth of information you have about our loons.
Yes, thank you so much. I enjoyed the opportunity too.
It was really a pleasure. Is there a way people can kind of follow along with the work that you do?
Sure. They can, and a lot of people have just asked me questions by emailing me.
Okay.
So I don't have a website or anything, but I can send them to the appropriate website. So if they just email me at birding, grab your binoculars and go out birding.
Right.
Birding, BIRDING, with my last name attached, all lowercase letters, ABTS, birding apps, ABTS, @gmail.com, then I can show them some of the other great resources that are out there. There's wonderful books by Dr. David Evers and his wife. They're the best books, especially for lay people like ourselves. And James Peruk has a brand new book that's just out. And then there's lots of websites, too. The Loon Watch website in Wisconsin has all frequently asked questions and great photos. And how can you tell if a chick is 1 week old or 2 or 3 or 4, 6 weeks old, 8 weeks old? Lots of good stuff out there.
Outstanding. Sherry, thank you so much. I suspect we'll be checking back in maybe in the spring when we start to see the loons come back. We can kind of get an update on things that you've learned over the winter season. I'd really appreciate that.
Yeah, that would be great. Thank you so much, Brett.
Thank you. Sherry Apps, the Loon Ranger, giving us the lowdown on loons here in the fall. The Wilderness Update is brought to you by the BWCAW Coalition in partnership with federal, state, nonprofit, and business organizations with the goal of preventing the introduction of aquatic invasive species into the Boundary Waters Canoe Area Wilderness. You're in tune to the End of the Road Radio, 94.5 WELY.